Welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's narration is A Civilization in Britain 2000 BC, Part 3. 57. Philology would seem to favour the idea that tin was obtained first from India. The Greek for tin is cassiteros. The Sanskrit kassilira is said to be derived from cash, to sign. Because much tin is found in the islands off the coast of India, some have supposed that the Easterners, whoever they were, got the name of the metal from India. India may have been the original source, but the Easterner seems to have turned his face quite early towards the west. Perhaps one of his earliest Western sources was Tuscany, where tin still occurs in irregular patches. 58. Tin is found in other parts of Western continental Europe, notably in Brittany, at Pyrenees near the mouth of Loire, and at Villedieu in Morbihan. But Cornwall has from time immemorial been the place for tin. And with reference to ancient Cornish tin workings, we find Professor Gowland writing, "In Cornwall, the conditions for the production of the metal tin were especially favourable. The ore was undoubtedly abundant and subterranean mining operations were not required, as it was found either at the surface of the ground or at but little depth below is disseminated through the old river gravels. From the fusibility of tin and the comparative ease with which the ore is reduced, the metal must have been produced in Cornwall not long after Neolithic man settled there." 59. Tin was first found in small grains, black tin or tin oxide, in the beds of streams and on the seashore. Within living memory, Cornish miners, when out of work, made in some cases a fair living by vanning. Armed with a pail and the flat Cornish shovel, the out-of-work miner would go to a sandy beach, take up in his shovel patches of sand, which he knew from experience would be likely to contain black tin, and with a peculiar motion of the shovel, difficult to describe, he would separate the sand from the black tin. The sand he would throw away. The black tin he would place in his pail to be sold ultimately to the tin smelter. The man himself would say he was streaming or vanning, and streaming is reminiscent of the time when his ancestors got the black tin from streams. For Bronze Age man did exactly the same as modern man, only he used a wooden pail and a wooden shovel. The streamer of a generation ago was an excellent example of what Sir Arthur Mitchell called the past in the present. An old streamer once told me that in a lucky week he sometimes earned as much as £2, equivalent to nearly £4 in our money of today, but the streamer is now no more. 60. To sum up, Egyptians, or Easterners, or whatever we please to call them, were here probably in the latter part of the Neolithic Age, seeking pearls and gold, valued on account of the religious ideas attached to them. Later they came for utilitarian purposes, to find tin to harden copper and make it into bronze. The listener's attention may now be drawn to a map of England and Wales in which the megalithic areas are dotted. It will be seen that there are no megaliths in Lincolnshire, Norfolk, Suffolk, Essex, Cambridge, Huntingdon, Bedford, Hertford, Middlesex and Surrey. Just the counties destitute of metals. But we find good evidence of megaliths in Cornwall and Devonshire, South Wales and the Lake District, just the areas where metals are abundant. It looks as though there is some connection between megaliths and metals, but we must not generalise too soon. Megaliths were, as we shall see, sacred things, and after what we have said regarding the holy character of gold and pearls, it will not surprise us to find all these holy things, megaliths, gold, pearls, in close conjunction. Did the pearl and metal seekers build the megaliths? But we must proceed. 62. Continuing our examination of the map, we note that the megaliths around Whitby are accounted for by the presence of jet, Whitby jet, famous in our time as the material from which mourning ornaments were made. Jet is found in Bronze Age graves, and it thus seems to have been connected with mourning from the second millennium before our era. But since the war, jet as an ornament of mourning has gone out of fashion, and Whitby jet is now no more. Thus, capricious fashion destroys a custom 4,000 years old. 63. The conjunction of flint and megaliths admits of a possible explanation. Machines are men's tools in this age of machinery, and we find the population of Britain at present most dense just where those essentials of machinery, coal and iron, are to be found. Similarly, in the latter part of the Stone Age, we have evidence of numerous people in the chalk areas, just where flint, the essential for man's early tools, was to be found. Hence the abundant proofs of Neolithic man's presence on the upper chalk of Dorset and Wiltshire, and hence perhaps Avebury and Stonehenge. The presence of flint may account for Kit's Coity House, the only megalith preserved in eastern and southeastern England. 64. Copper and lead account for the megaliths found in South Wales and the Lake and Peak districts, while the presence of tin seems the cause of the menhirs, cromlechs and circles in Cornwall and Devon. The quest of gold and pearls gives a clue to the presence of megaliths in North Wales and in Anglesey. 65. The haematite of the Northampton iron sands was once used as a colouring matter. The blood is the life, and corpses were once coloured red to give blood, life and strength to the beloved one in the world to come. Perhaps we may be able to return in a later essay to the fascinating questions of jet, haematite, amber, shells and white stones found in prehistoric graves. 66. Before finally leaving the map, we may study the directions of the ancient trackways, and it will be noted that, generally speaking, the trackways seem to run through or near the metal megalithic areas. Also, that the trackways appear to radiate from two centres, the London and the Stonehenge areas. Stonehenge may be regarded as the Rome or Canterbury of prehistoric times, and London appears to have been a trading centre from time immemorial. Dr. Rendell Harris has shown the probability that the Watling in Watling Street is of Egyptian origin, and has pointed out that this prehistoric way may have been constructed by the Egyptians. What if many more of these ancient tracks are also of Egyptian origin? 67. The phrase mines and megaliths, sometimes used instead of metals and megaliths, is not strictly speaking correct, as there was very little mining, as we understand the term, in prehistoric times. Early man found gold and tin as alluvial deposits. Other metals he quarried rather than mined. Still, the phrase, helped as it is by apt alliteration's artful aid, may be allowed to stand. The hypothesis of the conjunction of mines and megaliths holds not only for England and Wales, but also for other parts of the world. Space forbids us to deal with more than two, India and Mexico. Major Munn, inspector of mines to the Nizam of Hyderabad, says that cromlechs are thickest in the Deccan, just where the country is riddled with old workings for gold, copper and iron. In Mexico, according to Mr. W. J. Perry, archaic ruins are plentiful near the railway lines. The same motive led men of the archaic civilization to build cities in these spots, as caused modern engineers to construct the railways, and that motive was the lure of metals. 68. The following remarks seem to give general support to the theory of the conjunction of mines and megaliths. Monsieur de Morgan points out that the distribution of cromlechs is explained by their association with ancient gold and copper mines. Professor Gordon Child writes, "It is no accident that the oldest and most numerous Western megaliths cluster around the south coasts of Brittany and the Channel Islands, for it is just here that early voyagers travelling to the gold fields of Ireland and the amber coasts of Denmark would be most likely to call, and gold was once found in Brittany too." And again, "Megalithic tombs are often found in regions rich in tin and copper, Sardinia, Portugal, the Cevennes, and Cornwall, or gold, Portugal, Brittany, Ireland, or silver, Spain, Sardinia, or amber, Denmark. But the coincidence between the distribution of megaliths and metals is by no means exact, which is only a way of saying that there is an exception to every rule." 69. Mr. W. J. Perry has made this subject especially his own, and has shown that megalithic monuments cluster thickest in and around those regions which produced gold, copper, tin, amber, and pearls, especially if those regions were near the sea or on ancient trade routes. Professor G. Elliot Smith admirably sums up when he says that the theory metals, megaliths, not only holds for England and Wales, but seems to apply to the whole world, with the possible exception of Australia. The theory has, however, been hotly contested, as all new theories are, by the majority of archaeologists, but on the whole it seems to hold its ground. 70. Our stone circles are believed to have been erected by sun worshippers, our cromlechs by those who practiced the cult of the dead, and both circle and cromlech seem to have been built by metal seekers. Sun worship, cult of dead, metal seeking, all point to the east, and preferably to Egypt, but the claims of Mesopotamia and of the eastern Mediterranean, although not noticed in this paper, must not be forgotten. 71. Mines and megaliths. Mines and megaliths, there they have been, side by side, for 3,000 to 4,000 years, yet it was not until this generation that the conjunction was noticed. Really, we are not half so observant or half so clever as we sometimes think we are. 72. But to return to our subject. It is hoped that the listener now considers the following facts fairly well established. Number 1. That Britain once had a fair abundance of pearls and gold. And number 2, that the possession of these sacred treasures impelled the ancient Egyptians and others to seek our shores, perhaps as early as the 3rd millennium before our era. 73. We have now the task of demonstrating that these ancient Egyptians and other peoples may have introduced some of their civilization here. Objections we have to meet are that they could have come only in boatloads, that their sojourn here was but a brief one, and that they could not possibly have affected the ancient inhabitants of these islands to any appreciable extent. 74. Our answer is that the Egyptians were most probably colonists here, not transient visitors, and accordingly their influence upon the Aborigines must have been profound. Professor Fleurer, in his investigations on the physical characteristics of the Welsh, found dark, stalwart, broad-headed men on certain coastal patches, often curiously associated with megaliths in Wales. These men differ from the Welsh, and similar types have been found about Wicklow in Ireland, once famous for its gold, in Cornwall, still noted for its tin, and elsewhere. Professor Fleur is of opinion that these dark, broad-headed people have some of the blood of the people who built the megaliths. The people who built these megalithic monuments were not here today and gone tomorrow. They had permanent trading stations and colonies in these islands, and they formed alliances, matrimonial or otherwise, with the natives. 75. As Professor Elliot Smith observes, new customs and beliefs were not adopted at most of the places where the ancient mariners must have touched in their voyages. It was only in those localities where gold mines or pearl beds caused them to tarry and compel the local population to work for them in exploiting these new sources of wealth that the new knowledge took root. It was only when the more cultured aliens dominated the Aborigines and forced them to do the things that they, the immigrant minority, wanted done that these things were done. Reason plays a surprisingly small part in such advances, except on the part of the real pioneers. For the herd, it is either actual compulsion or moral suasion that brings about the change. In most cases, only actual compulsion can affect such advancement. 76. Our civilization has had great effect, for good or ill, upon subject races of a low degree of culture, such as are to be found in southern Africa and India. Its effect upon such a country as China has been all but negligible. According to Dr. Rivers, the more developed and highly organized the culture of a country, the less is the effect upon it of our own people. In such a country as China, the effect of European influence has been slow, and in amount is still very slight. In India, again, it is doubtful whether, except in material culture, our influence has really been much greater. We have had little effect on social structure, on the caste system, on language, or on religion, and it is noteworthy that the greatest effect has been in those parts of India where the indigenous culture has remained at a relatively low level. It is only in the south that the English language and the Christian religion have obtained any hold on the people. 77. It has been said that the last glacial epoch had hardly passed away in Britain before evidence is found of foreign adventurers and traders on our shores. The Aborigines of Britain, whoever they were, had had no time to develop. Their culture was necessarily low, and it easily fell before the infinitely superior culture from the East. 78. In Cornwall, the dark, broad-headed people referred to in a previous paragraph are popularly supposed to be the descendants of sailors wrecked in the Spanish Armada. I have written popularly. I ought rather to have written generally. A university man once told me that this idea of Spanish descent must be true. The fact was recorded in Mr. So-and-so's Family Bible. We know fairly well where most of the ships of the Armada were wrecked, many of them off the northwest coast of Scotland. There was no record whatever of even one ship of the Armada having been wrecked off the coast of Cornwall. Dr. Rendell Harris, in a series of brilliant essays, has shown that the ancient Egyptians were great colonizers, and he has gone so far as to indicate very possible sites of ancient Egyptian colonies in Britain. These Cornish Spaniards have some of the blood of the Egyptian colonists, of the men who built the megaliths, and if these Cornish Spaniards had kept their pedigrees, they could proudly boast of an ancestry not as recent as AD 1588, but as far back as 1588 BC. 79. Still, we cannot yet state as an absolute fact that the Egyptians were colonists here, although the presumption is exceedingly strong. And so we have to meet the challenge that a boatload of people could not have influenced a whole host of Aborigines. The answer is far easier than at first sight appears. Professor Elliot Smith observes, I would like to remind those who maintain that small groups of men cannot effect any influence in a foreign land what Pizarro accomplished in 1532. With a mere handful of men, he dominated the vast powers of the Incas. There is no reason why these earlier adventurers, the prospectors or the Children of the Sun, should not have dealt with the Americans, or indeed with any other natives of their day, in much the same way as Pizarro did. Other instances may be given. About 1804, 27 convicts escaped from New South Wales to the Fijian Islands, where they acquired great influence, largely due to their firearms, and if they had been more worthy representatives of their race, their influence might have been greater still. The story of Sir James Brooke reads more like a medieval romance than a piece of 19th century history. He is euphemistically said to have been imbued with the spirit of the old adventurers of Elizabethan times. In reality, he was a gentleman in search of adventure in the southern seas. Backed by the crew of one small brig, he landed at Sarawak, Borneo in 1839 and speedily got himself acclaimed Raja and Governor of Sarawak, a kingly position held by his descendants to this day. 80. Big brains, backed by a modicum of force, will generally win their way among peoples possessed of more force but less brains. Most of our really good things came from the East, and there is nothing wildly improbable in supposing the possibility of a boatload of ancient metal seekers or Easterners dominating the Aborigines and introducing their civilization among them. The hypothesis that the first civilization in these islands was introduced by Eastern metal seekers is not to be dismissed with a superior sneer. Time will show that there is more in it than some of us at present will admit. 81. To sum up, we may consider it as approved that the ancient Britons who opposed the Roman invasions were civilized and not the barbarians they are generally considered to have been. Further, we may agree that a strong presumption has been established that there was a civilization here, archaic, not modern, intrusive, not indigenous, perhaps as early as 2000 BC. Just think of the prospect which this idea calls up. Leaving out of consideration sundry lacunae of darkness, doubt, and uncertainty, we have a fairly continuous history of Britain for nearly 2,000 years, from the first invasion of Caesar to the present day. But there is another history of 2,000 years duration, from the end of the Stone Age to the first Roman invasion. In other words, there is as much history of Britain to learn as we already know. Here and there we get a fact or two, a glimpse or two of light. We are like little children who try to put together a jigsaw puzzle, of which most of the pieces are missing. But more and more pieces are being discovered every day, and although we can never expect to find them all, yet we may dare to hope to find so many as to be in a position to make a reasonable inference regarding the nature of the whole picture. Perchance before the next century is far advanced, the history of Britain will be commenced not at 55 BC, the date of the invasion of Julius Caesar, but at around 2000 BC, the approximate date of the erection of Avebury. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for more Albion narrations in the future at radioalbion.com.